warm welcome to everyone. Hope you're feeling well. So let's invite you at the beginning. Let's just make ourselves comfortable and just enjoy a few sensitive, quiet moments together to begin. So, I'm reluctant to overload you with more information. And so, if you do feel, whoa, really full of words, then already it's actually perfectly fine. If you'd rather go outside and just walk around, that's completely fine with me. I honestly won't be insulted. But you can also do the great practice of just letting information go in through the one ear and come out through the other one. And if there's anything really useful, it'll probably stay in our minds. Yeah, but the rest it can just wash by. So one of the features that we've been bringing into being as we practice is ways that lessen the demand on life's. Do you hear that funny sound, Adam? No? Just we hear it? There's like a rolling, it's something in the mic, I think. Is it trapped anywhere? Yes, it was coming from your mic, yeah. It's better. Well, let's see how it goes. I think it was something when you plugged it in. I'm not sure if it is it plugged all the way in into the computer or anything like that. Great. Well, we'll see how it goes. It didn't matter for us, but we probably couldn't have heard your translation very well. But I don't think everyone in the room can hear it. But I'm not sure how the recording will be. So just for that. Okay. So I was saying, we're practicing in ways that lessen the demand on life's appearances. And hopefully this has been working. Yes. The sense of anything being problematic lessens. And there can also be this feeling of things that we didn't even feel were problematic can also lessen. And so some of you have spoken about like a feeling of more joy coming through, or a feeling of more peacefulness coming into. And so we could say that those qualities are released, or we're able to tune into them more, however you want to put that. And so we can say that the sense of dukkha in that moment is lessened. And so today, bringing attention to the dukkha in our experience, and we can just lessen it more and more. So we've already had quite a lot of metaphors on this retreat. But I want to show you another metaphor that I'm not sure, maybe, certainly we shared it last year. I'm not sure if we invented it here last year, so we'll have to see. And this may only really exist in my imagination, but at one time, I've seen one of those sound mixing boards that they use when they're recording music. And it seemed like, there were loads and loads of these fading dials where you can push up and down and bring in different instruments and pull down another one. Does that make sense? Yeah, so that we can kind of turn up the volume of certain things and we turn down the volume of other parts of our experience. We're kind of working this sound mixing board of existence. But in this mixing board, and I think this can happen in a music studio, is that there are a few of them are actually linked together. And so this is the sense of mixing board. So we've noticed that the sense of tanha, of demanding on life, and the sense of dukkha, they're actually linked together. You move either one up and down, the other one moves up and down. Tanha, demanding, and dukkha, stressful. So it isn't possible to pull down demanding and push up dukkha. You know, they depend on each other. They're linked together on this mixing board. But they're not the only ones that are linked. Also a sense of spaciousness in the body or in the awareness. So you pull down demand, you pull down dukkha, you also pull down contraction. There's less contraction. And so what we're exploring here is actually what the Buddha called the Second Noble Truth. And it's often expressed in a very kind of simplistic way, which is when there's a lot of dukkha, well, it's often said in a very simplistic way, which is like, what's the cause of all this dukkha? And then the Buddha answers his own question, as intelligent and wise people often do, and says, it is tanha. But we could actually try and answer the question in a different way while also translating the question better as well. When there's a lot of dukkha, what else is there? And so we see on the sound mixing board, when there's a lot of dukkha, there's also a lot of demand and there's also a lot of contraction. There's also a very strong sense of that object. There's a stronger sense of significance of that object in time also. So we would say there's a strong sense of time in this moment, and time pressure. You know, if there's a strong feeling of greed or aversion, it's not normally, yes, I must get round to that at some point. There's urgency. There's a sense of urgency. Yeah, and all of these contributing to a lack of peacefulness. And so we'll see there are many, many of these volumes in our experience which can be lessened. Another way of what we're saying here is that there are many pathways that we can practice which will lower, let's say like we're going to lower the urgency, just lower the urgency. And what happens? We also lower the dukkha, we lower the demand, we also fade the solidity of this object. So one of the dials we might have noticed is also adjusted here is the sense of self, the sense of self. When there's a lot of dukkha, there's this very profound sense of self and self-importance and the mission that the self has that it needs to do. And as the dukkha fades, as the demanding fades, as the object in attention fades, and with that urgency, also that sense of self fades, softens, becomes quieter. And so each time we notice a new feature on our self of mixing board, we get a new practice. And so one of these dials was taking the niceness opinion as a fact. The less we take an opinion as a fact, the less dukkha there is. The less dukkha, the more freedom. more unification, the more gathered we can be in that freedom. And the more we can delight in that sense of freedom, the less we feel inclined to go into patterns of behavior that lead to dukkha. And as we mentioned this morning, where on this sense of mixing dal is the real level of appearances? Yeah. So we have this very strong sense of the appearance of the thing, and then it kind of fades down, fading and fading, to maybe disappearing altogether. And we go from time with a sense of urgency, going down subtler and subtler, more spacious, more quiet, till time. And then we have this sense of self with a great deal of self-importance and strength and power. And we can turn that one down, quieter and quieter, actually getting more delightful, more enjoyable to be with. And maybe that gets quieter and quieter. And as objects disappear, as time disappears, maybe the sense of self. So just as we asked this morning, what then is the true independent nature of an appearance? If the sense of self, the sense of time, the sense of an object depends on dukkha, a sense of self, time, object, they depend on dukkha, what's really their true nature? The sense of self, we shouldn't necessarily confuse these things, the sense of these things, with their real nature. Maybe it's not the same thing. You know, maybe there's, if we use the example of time, maybe there's an atomic time ticking by, you know, perfectly according to whatever it is, the half-life of something or other. And maybe through meditative powers, I can't stop an atomic clock. But I can change my sense of time and time pressure. Can have a sense of time flowing freely, like time flies when you're in a joyful experience. I can have a sense of slowing down time in the way that, you know, time stood still in that moment before this thing hit this other thing, this accident happened. Yeah, because they all depend on the atmosphere of paying attention. That's what they do. So when we have access to this mixing board, where are we going to place the sense of self along here? Because when we have a lot of dukkha, a lot of demanding, we get strong objects and a fixed feeling of self. And when we lessen that demanding, we lessen the grasping onto the object in attention, the object starts to fade. And along with that object, the self-sense and the mission built around it fades with it. So the first insight here is that the sense of self changes according to the object. The sense of self is actually a spectrum that we move through the day. The sense of self arises in relationship to objects and atmospheres. The sense of self is not an independent thing, it depends on other things. And so we have to allow for this sense that that our sense of self is not something that doesn't change. And yet that's not how we normally feel about our sense of self, our sense of ourself. I think John Kabat-Zinn used this popular phrase, "Everywhere you go, there you are," or something like this. Yeah, there I am again, doing that thing. But it's not the same me who's having this experience. It's different. And so we actually get identified with an appearance in consciousness, which is this sense of how I am right now. Every moment of experience has a sense of self sensing it, right? You can sense that. And so, in a certain way, there's a sense of self sensing this sense of self. And deciding if that sense of self is really the real sense of self that I sense. Yeah. And then we serve up our meditation like overcooked pasta, everything just, oh. And we feel, ah, yes, there's a sense of self here. And often we kind of feel ourselves to be, somewhere in here, just behind the eyes, looking out at the world. Whenever we go looking for this self, which is really just looking for this sense of this self, it's almost like we may find some footprints, but we never find this self. Presumed to exist, we do everything we can to support its needs, but impossible to find it. We have this body here, this lovely body we've been gifted by evolution and nature. And our sense of self may feel a sense of ownership or identification with this body. Which, in what way does this sense of self own a body or have a body belonging to it or be a body? And we could actually just kind of flip the idea and say, actually, this body is just nature. This is nature's body that we're looking after. We have to feed it. It won't feed itself. Every so often it'll say, "Take me to the toilet. I need to do something there." And it'll say, "Take the coat off or put the coat on. I'm too cold, too warm." It's like the joke that people who look after cats say, the cat doesn't belong to us, we belong to the cat. Maybe the body invented the sense of self to have someone to look after it. And when we change this way of relating to the body, maybe we can see it's actually a little bit more free. Sometimes when we feel like this is my body, we might treat it quite badly at times. if we have a sense, what does this body need? It needs, healthy food, exercise, and enough sleep. And because it belongs to me, I give it unhealthy food, I hunch it in front of the computer for long hours, and I give it the minimum amount of sleep so that I can get the maximum amount of life. So the idea is, what if I say this body doesn't belong to me, and then I look after it like I would look after a beautiful piece of nature? A teacher shared with me this concept one time, is to relate to the body as the nearest other to us. And that nearest other can be someone we use, or it can be someone we support. And we can see a similar pattern actually with our mind, with our thoughts. We've said before, and you've no doubt noticed it before, we don't decide what thoughts we think. Thoughts just appear, right? Intentions just appear. And so, which thoughts then do we want to support being thought in this being? So we have this sense, thoughts are just appearing in this. But there still feels to be this space where, even though it doesn't make sense to think I am thinking this, it's just occurring, there still feels to be enough space. Just as with the body, I can care for it. With the thoughts, I can encourage it or I can disencourage this thought. So there's always this subtle middle way here. With the body, the middle way of letting go of the sense of self is the middle way between abandoning and possessing. And so what we would use is a word of stewardship. Does that make sense? Like stewardship. The steward of the land doesn't own the land. They look after it. Like what the nature organizations do. They look after the national parks, that kind of. But they don't indulge in that absurdity of saying, I own this piece of the world. And, we also say, I own this body, and I can turn on and off the heartbeat, the healing mechanism. When you cut, I decide when it does and it doesn't. No, the body is belonging to nature as nature's. And so with our thinking, we also need a healthy dose of non-identification. We have to have quite a healthy dose of not being, not tricking ourselves into thinking that we're fixed and definable by our thoughts. And we have this sense that thoughts just happen. The thought occurred to me. And so it matters that the thought occurred to me, and I have received the thought, and I would. And so this is a teaching actually that opens out the possibility to engage with thinking in a very skillful way. So far on the retreat, we haven't spoken so much about types of thoughts. And we've just kind of come back to the present, created good atmospheres. In the suttas, there's one sutta that's called something like Two Sorts of Thinking. And it tells a story. The Buddha says, "Why don't I divide all my thinking into two sorts? All the thoughts that occur to me into two sorts." And makes this evaluation that there are basically thoughts which are tanha and dukkha, and there are thoughts which are metta and freedom. And speaks about these thoughts which are hindrances, and so in the dukkha pile. And that includes greed for the senses, something for the senses, body, heart, mind, senses. Oh, get something for them. Thoughts of aversion in the mind and ill will. And that includes all kinds of rejection. But then a third part, which is actually wanting to cause harm. Wanting to cause harm. And so all the thoughts that kind of arise in that way, we just put that into the sort of thinking, that's dukkha thinking. And so all of this non-metta way of thinking causes anxiety, it causes disharmony. It causes friction and agitation in the mind. Right. And it causes distrust in our communities. And so the kind of underlying point then is like, so why on earth am I doing that? And then the Buddha says, and so I wiped them out of existence. Which is just to say, I pulled down the mixing desk to zero on those. And so we can see, a thought that's not being thought anymore is just wiped out of existence. It's not really kind of aversive or dramatic. It's just, I'm not going to think that anymore. And so it's wiped out of existence. And so the key here is we don't identify with the thoughts, then we can evaluate the thoughts, and then we can let go of the thoughts. And we don't mistake thoughts for self, and we don't mistake self for the thoughts. And then he was saying, and this other sort of thinking, sometimes the thoughts of renunciation or generosity comes up in relationship to the world. Thoughts of kindness and care and compassion. Wishing well for others. And the Buddha reflects on these and says, ah, I don't think there's a lot of harm that's going to come from thinking these. And I could allow these to be thought in this being, and they wouldn't create any difficulty for myself and for others. And actually, in other places, they're expressed as kind of like really expansive qualities of the heart and mind. They really open us and expand what we can feel ourselves to be. And then he kind of ends this sutta by saying, and I could go on thinking that for a really long time, except it would make me tired. And a tired mind is far from being gathered and unified. And so I let those ones go as well. So the Buddha was really enjoying having that mixing level, really, really low. It was a very, very low and enjoyable vibe. And then he decides, I'm just going to pull it all the way down to zero. Really had a taste for peace. And so tomorrow we can bring this in as a practice. How do we play along that dial of that sense of self? But I just want to leave with the clarity of the point. This again is a middle way. So the truth point here is less important than the usefulness point. We have a default setting which says, I have a self and I need to look after myself and get things for myself or get rid of things for myself. And because we like simplicity, we might switch over to the other side and say, I don't have a self and there's no point getting anything for myself or getting rid of anything for myself. And so there's no point doing my practice because there's no self anyway. The Buddha would say, I teach neither self nor not self, but the middle way. And maybe the Buddha, but certainly Nagarjuna would take it even further. And it's not that I teach both, and I don't teach neither either. Yeah. So it's a middle way, not just through left and right and up and down and forwards and backwards. It's not even a middle way in any kind of directions. It's just the middle way. So neither true nor not true. Something's useful. And so we can adopt this view. This body, not really mine. Nature's body, perhaps. These thoughts just happening. To be supported for a while or not, and then eventually released. So let's just have a quiet minute together to close the session.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.